Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Back. This is our second hour for Interpreter Radio. Kevin Christensen with us by phone, John Keith Studio, and Aaron Studio. We are co-hosting Interpreter Radio tonight, which is Sunday, July 11th, 2021. We are now, for our second hour, Come Follow Me lesson that deals with Section 89, the Word of Wisdom. We're also going to talk about Section 90, 91, and 92, which includes the Apocrypha and whether it should be translated or not, which ties into the Joseph Smith translation. And we've got a few topics, but of course the major one is the Word of Wisdom, which has a fascinating history. And as we go along, I'm sure we'll have a few suggestions for different sources one might go to. Kevin, would you like to start us off with the Word of Wisdom, maybe a little background or general comments about the Word of Wisdom, Section 89?
Well, just growing up with it is something that I've come to appreciate just as a blessing in my own life. That I could see, my wife tells a story about going to meet one of her friends that she'd known in college and going to see her after, 10 or 15 years later, and they were standing in front of a mirror together, and their friend looked at Shauna and just decided, just looking into the mirror, that it was time for her to quit smoking. And I remember just growing up reading, things talking about how statistically the LDS would tend to live 10 or 11 years longer than the average because of our health code. And I remember a funny passage in one of the books on the Hoffman case where guy said that you couldn't trust Mormons because their health code makes them look younger than they really are.
That's a great comment.
I've always loved that. That's almost worth reading the book for. But it's been something that I could immediately see growing up, because even though I grew up in a mostly LDS neighborhood, it was just mostly LDS, not totally LDS. And there were people who didn't take the Word of Wisdom seriously and sometimes go into their homes for this or that occasion growing up. And I always felt like that there was something really different going on, something that I appreciated the difference. And then just over the years, it's been something that, I've really appreciated and love about the church being involved for many years in the LDS Addiction Recovery Program, seeing how difficult it's been for some people to get away from something that they know is hurting them. That they know that tobacco is hurting them, that they know alcohol is hurting them, that they know other kinds of drug abuse is hurting them, and how difficult it is to stop. And how yet also that the scriptures themselves, would contain the 12 steps of addiction recovery, and how that this is how this works and how it's a spiritual program, that will help people get physically better, immediately after letting go of like a tobacco addiction or alcohol addiction. Just within months and years, damage, that caused, people begin to heal. So a lot of getting away from it is, starting on the right path is they start getting the benefits immediately. And the Word of Wisdom itself talks about the blessings there at the end, that they shall receive health in their navel, marrow in the bones, shall find wisdom and great treasures of knowledge, even hidden treasures, and shall run and not be weary, and shall walk and not faint. And I, the Lord, give them a promise that the destroying angel shall pass by them as the children of Israel and not slay them. So that's something that's there, and we've occasionally heard, some interesting stories in general conference about how people have in extremely dire situations have called on those blessings. But, I've seen it. My mom's 102, and she's sharp as a tack and knows everything and knows what's going on with all of her extended family and tells us the stories. She's just there. And she's always been very, very enthusiastic about it. Not obsessive, but just kept it as a Word of Wisdom, and including The physical fitness. When I grew up, one of the things that would come on the TV is Jack LaLanne, and I remember as a kid, doing little exercises on leading the way. So this idea that we've got these bodies, these temples, and we should take care of them and not let them rule over us, because it's something to be warned about. It's important to be warned about and forewarned. Like in verse 8, I'm talking about wine and wrong drink. It's not good. And recent studies talking about how every time a person drinks alcohol, every time they lose brain cells to it.
Yeah, and I never drink and never have because I need all the brain cells I can keep.
Yeah, we all do.
Yeah. It's funny you brought up Jack LaLanne years ago on this very station on K-Talk. I briefly had a chance to interview Jack LaLanne, who by then was in his 80s, and each year would do a little loop around part of San Francisco Bay, adding a new little fishing boat, just a little 16-foot tin boat behind him, so that by the time he was in his 80s, he had like 80 boats each, the fishing boats that he was towing along behind him in San Francisco Bay. And I thought, a 16-year-old who was on some fancy swim team couldn't do that. And you got Jack LaLanne, he was an amazing guy. He was also very small. He was, maybe 5'6" or something. He was not a large person. It was a very remarkable man, and I appreciated his enthusiasm and energy. I appreciate you bringing him up, Kevin. That's kind of fun.
I had to chuckle about your comment about making look younger, because I think I'm the youngest of the three of us, but I look the oldest.
Oh, I'm not sure about the look the oldest part, but I'm quite sure.
Well, I've got the white hair to prove it.
Yeah, well, that just may mean you're not vain enough to color like somebody else here. But anyway, all right. So background and history on the Word of Wisdom. There's a great source for this that's, if somebody's interested, it's Journal of Discourses, Volume 12, page 158, where Brigham Young, in one of his addresses, stands up and says, although I wasn't there, I've heard from many of the brethren who were, about the 22 who were there above the Newell Whitney store, and about what led to the revelation now known as the Word of Wisdom. And he talks about, the brethren having, after they had breakfast, they'd go upstairs and they'd light up a cigar and they'd
get out the chewing tobacco.
Exactly, chewing tobacco after that. And when Joseph Smith came in to talk at these School of the Prophet episodes, that his head was in a big cloud of smoke, and Emma also complained to him. And between the two of those things, he inquired of the Lord about tobacco, and got much more than he was bargaining for. It was not just about tobacco. It's, you ask about tobacco. Okay, well, let's talk about strong drink and meat and exercise and tea and coffee and a whole bunch of other things. And it's just this remarkable example of how when Joseph Smith sought something, like in the first vision, and here again, he gets way more than he's expecting.
Or section 76, where he wants to an explanation of one verse, and suddenly he gets 100 more. I think one of the things that's interesting is this is verse 4, and you touched on this, Kevin, a little bit ago. But this is, he's given in consequences of evils and designs which do and will exist in the hearts of conspiring men in the last days. We don't particularly touch on that a lot, but I think because if you want to look for this stuff, you don't have to look very far. But the fact that some of these substances, which are not good, there are people who intentionally promote this for usually just personal profit, but doesn't rule out other nefarious schemes. But it's that this isn't going to be necessarily just innocent promotion on some of the these substances that we have to deal with. Another thing that really strikes me anytime I read it is some of the language, like verse 6. When he's talking about the sacraments, it should says, "This should be wine, yea, pure grape of the vine of your own make," which is a strange locution to us. But back in Joseph Smith's day, any time you crushed a grape, you were letting in the spores that would start fermenting it. And there was no way to stop that process until 1868, when Thomas Welsh figured out how to pasteurize the thing and then preserve it as grape juice so that it didn't ferment if you stored it properly and sanitary. Otherwise, then those yeast spores would go in and start converting the sugars in the grapes into alcohol, and the further along it would go along further and further until the yeast died in its own waste products, and at about 5%, and so, which is by modern standards fairly tame. They've figured out how to concentrate those. But that strange language there is necessary because there wasn't a word, grape juice, to describe that. There wasn't a substance, grape juice, that you described that, because if you made juice from grapes, it already started fermenting and turning into wine. And so that's one of the peculiarities of the vocabulary that is describing something that didn't exist at the time.
Another fascinating point about the history of Section 89 is how long it took for it to become absolutely permanent and binding on the church. Very soon after it came, and of course it's a principle with a promise, but very early on, Brigham Young and others were pushing the idea that this ought to be something that's binding. But what it meant still was uncertain by the saints. It took decades for them to talk about whether or not strong drink meant, well, beer was okay, but something stronger was bad, and sorting through whether or not a little of this was okay, but a lot was bad. And we still do a little bit of that today when you have wheat for man and corn and ox for the animals. We don't say, well, that means you can never eat corn or you can never eat oats and we can only eat wheat. We sort of interpret that our own way, and there are different ways over time. And in a fascinating article that was published by an LDS guy at the University of Utah that sort of brought the caffeinated drinks into the whole mix, and the whole history of it is quite interesting in terms of how the saints have interpreted it and lived it. And yet I really love that. I really like it because it's an example of how God can give us a principle and the church doesn't dictate how we are to live it to the nth degree. They give us a principle and tell us, use your very best judgment with it. And I really appreciate that.
Well, and even in the universality of the word of wisdom, if you have a problem with, if you have a word of wisdom problem, You're not excommunicated from the church. They won't pull you in for a church council. You can't have a temple recommend. But it's not essential to your membership in the kingdom. And one of the things that I appreciated once about a bishop that I had, and this was told to me by the member, is he said the member had a word of wisdom problem, and the bishop said, if every person's sin had a smell attached to it, sacrament meeting would be a rather stinky place. But don't let that deter you from coming.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, worth remembering in the context of this is, yes, it is expected of members, but it's a requirement for a temple recommend and not for membership. Although, well, I guess I have to temper that because you need to be keeping the word of wisdom to be baptized.
To be baptized, but afterward there are many people who become inactive or anyway, yeah. One of my great experiences as a home teacher many years ago was going to visit an inactive guy who just smoked. I mean, he would have fit right into the original School of the Prophets. You know, there was this built there, you know, a couple of feet of cigarette smoke at the top of the ceiling whenever we went to visit him, and it was tough to visit and nice to get out of there, but he was just a really wonderful guy, and we kept inviting him to come out to church. And finally, one day I said, "Guy, you know, we'd really like you to come, and you sound like you're interested in living the gospel. What can we do?" And he said, "I can't go for 3 hours without a cigarette." And I said, "You know what? That's great. It would be my greatest pleasure to stand out in the parking lot between sacrament meeting and Sunday school and Sunday school and priesthood meeting while you have a cigarette in the parking lot of the church." And I did. And I think he, you know, appreciated the fellowship. And that's not, he would have been, of course, much better off if he didn't smoke. But it was so much better that he was at church, even with that difficult addiction that he had, than to not be there because of the addiction. I was just thrilled that he was there, and I counted that one of my favorite moments from home teaching over the years. Kevin, your turn. I feel like I've talked too much here.
Yeah. Well, I have one of my friends, and the last ward I was in was a doctor, and sometimes when he would start, if you could just nudge him a little bit, he'd go off on a very well-informed rant about how if he wanted to design something to do the most possible long-term damage to the human body, so almost you couldn't go better than cigarettes. And he would talk about all of the ways that it affects you in terrible ways, and how much he would like encourage people to stop. But recognizing it's just not just a matter of saying, well, stop. You know, it's recognizing that this is an addiction. And addiction itself, it's not just behavior, it's a disease. And it's something where basically the more primitive parts of your brain have been taken over, and they've kind of been tricked into treating, you know, like, say, nicotine as a need, not desire. It becomes a need. And so instead of the cortex thinking, this is something I would like to have, let's work out how I can get it, we'll weigh the costs and benefits. Is this going to be good for me, and is this going to be too expensive? All of that goes by the board. Instead, the message comes up from, you know, the reptile part of the brain that says, get me some of that. I don't care what it costs. I need some of that. If I don't get that, I will die. And it's that message itself is false, but it feels real to the person who's an addict. And so the idea that the scriptures have this way of healing that damage is very important. You know, when people recognize that, yeah, I recognize that this is bad for me, what can I do? I'm addicted. Well, then that's when the addiction recovery program can come in and say, yeah, we understand that. And we have people who have been addicted too. And they will share their experience and fellowship with you. And they understand this and they'll help you get through it. And so there's this, you know, a path laid out for healing. And so much of the gospel is about healing. You know, not just recognizing, yeah, we all sin, we all get sick, we all make mistakes. There are ways to heal. And that the process of healing, the mind and the spirit is going to change. So the aspects of addiction are, it's an increased craving and impeded judgment. And 12-step recovery involves both healing the impeded judgment, because you start counting the costs, you write down, you read about, you know, the physical effects of it, and on the emotional costs of it. And you write all of this down, and then the grievances that a person has that support their self-justification. Well, I deserve it because of this, or that sort of thing. And that's the removing the self-judgment. Instead of using grievances to justify our behavior, you get rid of your grievances. And that's part of the healing of your mind and getting your thinking clear. And then helping a period of abstinence so that the body can heal. So, you know, both aspects of it heal, and there are actual physiological changes in the brain where the part that's been doing the craving actually shrinks back down to the size it should be. And the part that is doing the judging, you know, the frontal cortex actually grows as you do the writing and the thinking and the fellowshipping parts of 12-step work. So healing is real. It's not just a matter of stop sinning. It's a matter of embrace the path to healing.
Thinking also about the healing process, but also about the importance of the word of wisdom. About 5 years ago, I attended some conference where one of the speakers said, "Well, President Monson's a nice old man who tells story, but he doesn't really have anything important to say." And I thought, well, I disagree with that. But at the time, President Monson's health was failing. And so the most you could get is about a 5-minute conference talk. So he's going to choose one subject. And so I thought, well, what is it he's choosing to concentrate on? I did his talks, and I think the next was either the previous one or the following conference, he talked on the word of wisdom. That was the one thing that he talked about. If the prophet is only going to talk for 5 minutes, what does he choose to talk about? The word of wisdom. And I thought, well, that seems a little strange because if you're isolated in Utah, then the word of wisdom is generally followed. Or more commonly followed than it is in other places, but it still that doesn't seem like, you know, most people are aware of the dangers of smoking, that there are potential risks for drinking and so forth. And I was wondering why he would do that, and then I happened to be in Berlin and see all of the advertisements that they had for things like vaping, and they were everywhere. And so I realized that this was a specific prophetic warning about the need to follow the word of wisdom, even in some of these times where we think that most of the scientific evidence aligns behind the word of wisdom, that it's still a problem, and it's still one that we need to follow. And so I gained an appreciation for President Monson's choice for what to address for the saints when he only had 5 minutes to do so.
I have a suggestion for people who are listening. If you'd like a source that talks about the history of the Word of Wisdom, there's a marvelous article that's almost exactly 18 years old now that's from Volume 42, Issue Number 3 of BYU Studies. It was published on July 1st of 2003 by Paul Peterson and Ron Walker. It's called It's entitled Brigham Young's Word of Wisdom Legacy, and it's fabulous. It goes through in excruciating detail I shouldn't use the word excruciating if I think it's so fabulous. It goes through in minute detail about the word of wisdom and how Brigham Young is unfairly maligned because people who want to throw rocks at him say, oh, Brigham Young had a corner on the alcohol market in Utah. And that's true, but it leaves out the fact that he did that to quash it out everywhere else and still leave a little bit of an opening for older Latter-day Saints who couldn't yet break the addiction. He tried to thread the needle in many ways with this, but he was a stalwart and staunch advocate for the principles and the word of wisdom from the earliest days of the church. It wasn't until, if I remember right, 1921 when the word of wisdom was completely and finally made binding on the church, not just to get into the temple, but also to become a member. And the timing there has always struck me as fascinating for two reasons. First of all, because it took so long to come even remotely close to eradicating those addictions, which shows how very, very powerful they were. And the second point is that that's just about the time when automobiles started to get fast enough so that if you were drunk and driving one, you could really do some serious damage. And if the world as a whole would follow the word of wisdom to the extent that that the church advocates, there would be many, many lives saved every single year. That's probably the single greatest cause for deaths in the United States that are under the category of accidental. And it's just a huge number every year. Just sad.
Yeah. I also want to look at, when we're talking about the historical interpretations, verses 12 and 13 of 89, when it's talking about the use of meat. And this is one where, again, things have changed, but it's at least debatable which way to take the change. So it says that the flesh of beasts and the fowls of the air are ordained for the use of men, but they should not be used only in times of winter or of cold or famine. Now, there's two ways you can look at this, and I'm not going to decide which way is right, and maybe neither of them are, but one of them is back then you didn't have refrigeration. So your meat is going to spoil, and so it's pretty much only good in times of winter and cold, because you can't keep it. And the other thing is that for at least the northern hemisphere and the temperate regions where Joseph Smith was, you can't get grain and fresh fruits and vegetables in the winter. So you are using more of a meat diet, that part, because you don't have that available. And in the modern world, you have two developments. One is the refrigeration and freezing of both meat and vegetables, so you can use them all year round. And the other, so that makes vegetables available in the winter, and also the transportation networks that allow us to get fresh fruits and vegetables from the other side of the world, where it's not a problem. So you can use that to argue either that, well, now that we don't need meat in the winter, we shouldn't be eating it, or that now that we've got the refrigeration, it's okay to eat it in the summer. Opposite interpretations based on the same historical circumstances, and I won't pick a side right now.
There you go. And if somebody would like a great source that discusses some of these issues about interpretation and what they meant, I would suggest, and this is easy to find online, the Church's Doctrine and Covenants Institute manual, and it has some nice but succinct, you know, this is not some lengthy scholarly thing, but it gives you some nice summaries of these sections.
And you probably have to go to there instead of me.
Well, you said what is said in the Institute okay. manual. You did. I haven't read it.
Yeah.
Well, it's great, and it talks about refrigeration and times of winter and famine and also the idea of, you know, fruit in its season. Just as they didn't have refrigeration for meat, you couldn't get fruits and vegetables to last too long either in the summer, and they certainly weren't around in the winter. And so eating them in the season had special importance in those times as well. So and the idea in verse 12 about eating meat sparingly is a fascinating one. You know, there are some parts of the Word of Wisdom that church members today, when we feel like we're living in a time of fairly strict adherence and universal adherence to the Word of Wisdom, we still kind of pick and choose those ones that we want to live.
And yet, on the other hand, there are people with specific health problems. So one of the recommendations for things like anemia is that you increase your consumption of, because you need iron, you increase your consumption of animal flesh because that will get you the iron much faster than the vegetable sources. And so where this is one of those things where we need to have the wisdom in applying those and in utilizing these guidelines that we have to in such a way that it does promote our health.
And that again is dovetails in with the whole idea of greatly appreciating the church's approach of, well, here's the Word of Wisdom, use your best judgment, use your prayer and thought and personal ideas and own inspiration from God about how to apply it to you. So that's great.
Kevin, any thoughts?
Yes, Kevin.
Well, for all of the, there have been some differences of interpretation and degrees of enforcement. The church is still interested in this way. Like the Sunday school manual links to an essay called Physical and Emotional Health. That's the discussion of modern advice on taking care of ourselves. And I think it's a testament to the value of the advice is that, you know, quite literally, the saints tend to live 10 or 11 years longer than the general population. Now, that's something that you can't say, well, that's your interpretation. No, that's 10 or 11 years longer. That's really there. That's a real thing. And it's worth valuing and embracing and accepting the inspiration and value of it for what it is and saying, yeah, that's worth it. And so many of us just simply have, because we've grown up with it, we haven't had the problems that come with, you know, these like especially alcohol and tobacco addictions, you know, that are so, in a culture where it's taken for granted that everybody does it, there's nothing so tragic about the cost of those things because everyone's paying the cost and no one sees outside of it. But here we are outside of it and we're showing that there is a benefit and that you can have a happy life without it. You don't need it. In fact, you're going to have more life and a better quality of life without those things.
Speak to that issue in connection with verse 19, Kevin and John, which is the one that talks about wisdom and treasures of knowledge. The insights that the Word of Wisdom has for us are wisdom and treasures of knowledge for us that we wish others would also embrace.
Well, and don't forget verse 20 with the health benefits, run and not be weary. and walk and not faint. Those are also tangible benefits that come from that, although we tend to focus more on those with the word of wisdom. We can't exclude them. I'm going to let you give your thoughts on wisdom and great treasures and knowledge, and then I'll throw in my few bits.
Okay. Well, I think just some of, you know, the idea of the wisdom is just seeing how things interconnect and just taking care of ourselves and being responsible with ourselves and with, you know, our environment is going to, you know, be a benefit to us. And I think that just if we have, you know, better minds and clearer thinking and can learn and read and retain better because we're taking care of our bodies and not, you know, drinking ourselves into a stupor or even just destroying brain cells to a limited extent, there's an obvious and real benefit. And every time I talk to my mom, like I say, she's 102, she's sharp and alert, and you know, it's extraordinary to me. And you know, even when I have some relations who haven't lived as long as mom, there's just something about this as being something that she's just embraced, and it's literally had her living a full and long and healthy life. And I like that, and I've seen the outside and think what we have here is worth embracing at you know, at the expense of certain social contexts where we're just not going to fit in.
Well, my comment on it was a study I'd read that people who are involved in binge drinking suffer about a 10% loss in brain capacity. Well, if you're in education, that translates out to dropping a whole grade point. And since they were talking about college students, that seems apropos. But there are some things where a lot of the effects of the word of wisdom on things like tobacco, alcohol, and the interpretations of the brethren about use of drugs, particularly illegal ones, that those things tend to impede your thinking, and so you get the wisdom and treasures of knowledge that way, but it also really interferes with your ability to receive the Spirit and to be able to recognize the revelation when it's coming in and to act on it. And that is also a benefit of these wisdom and great treasures of knowledge, that it's hard to underestimate their importance.
Yeah. When I was in high school, I started reading books by Alistair MacLean. He's an adventure writer. He wrote The Guns of Navarone and several other things. And I remember reading his books up to one point and got into one of those books, and I just decided this isn't very good. And I stopped reading him. And then later I read a biography, and it said, oh, this was the time when his alcoholism kicked in. I just knew there was something wrong. I didn't know what it was. And later I found out, yeah, that was it.
So visible, something you could discern, but you didn't know where it was from till later. Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I wanted to add one thing that is kind of a side note, but is interesting. There was a University of Utah professor in 1918 named Fred Pack who published an article opining that the reason that tea and coffee were included by the Lord in the Word of Wisdom was because they had caffeine, the effects of which were being studied at that point in time by professors like Fred Pack and others. And so in his article, which was published in the New Era, he talks about how Latter-day Saints should abstain from Coca-Cola and other caffeinated drinks. And so that's where the caffeine and caffeinated drinks idea came from. It's interesting that as recently as 2012, when statements have been publicly made about that, the church has come out with official statements from the public relations department saying they take no position on caffeinated drinks, but we are still left to use our own good judgment. That doesn't mean, wow, caffeine's great and it's okay and I should, you know, it's again left to our own personal discretion. But I leave the history of that with you because it's kind of fascinating, and I would never suggest that people partake in caffeine. But I again find it wonderful that the church would leave it to our own discretion.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to, I'm going to skip 90 and go to 91.
Great. Tell everybody what 91 is. This is a great one.
Section 91 is the section on the Apocrypha. Now, it comes out of Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible, and Joseph Smith was using a Bible that had the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha are a group of books that were found in the Septuagint, that is a translation in ancient Greek of the Old Testament, that were not in the Hebrew Bible. So there's a collection about a dozen of them. If you want a really great overview of it, go to the Bible Dictionary. It lists them all until it gives you a summary of them. And so when it comes to translating the Apocrypha, does he need to do an inspired translation of the Apocrypha the way he's doing an inspired translation of the Bible? And he gets the revelation from the Lord and says, well, there are many things that are in are true, that it's mostly translated correctly, so he doesn't need to deal with it. There's also things in there that are not true. And so that he doesn't need to include the Apocrypha in his translation, and he doesn't. But he says, whoso readeth it, let him understand, for the Spirit manifested truth. And if you're enlightened by the Spirit, you can obtain benefit. If you're not, then you're not going to obtain benefit. Now, this is a very useful way, generalizing, of dealing with non-canonical ancient literature, and actually to some extent non-canonical modern literature. But so the Apocrypha are a really mixed bag. I've been through it all in the original. And as far as I can tell, for example, with Judith, I can't find anything historical. There are other parts of it that are really interesting, but it's debated. So the Apocrypha is part of the Catholic canon, but it's not part of the Protestant canon. And some of the material in 1st and 2nd Maccabees, you will find cited in church material. It's the only historical record we have of that time period for the area in Judea for the Jews who had come back from Babylon. So we're heavily dependent upon it for our historical information. So there are parts in it that are really good. There are some edifying things in the Maccabees. There are some things that aren't particularly edifying. That's just true of most histories. And some of them are interesting for cultural points of view. But it's a really mixed bag. And I've known people in the church who, not so much now, but 40 years ago, who would really push apocryphal literature and pseudepigraphic literature and all this wonderful stuff in there. There's some interesting things in there and some things I really like, but there's also copious amounts of garbage. And a lot of it is just made up. And, you know, some of it was edifying fiction anciently. And maybe people didn't necessarily realize it was fiction. But it's a really mixed bag. And so you have to know when you're... And there's a voluminous literature out there. If you start looking at Nag Hammadi and pseudepigrapha and looking through the Mishnah, and that you have to be prepared that some of it's true and some of it's not. And some of it you can benefit by reading, and if the Spirit prompts you, and otherwise you probably aren't going to get a lot of benefit out of it. And I'm reminded of a quote from C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letter. The Devil Screwtape says that that these days ancient books are only read by the learned, and we have now so dealt with the learned that they are of all people the least likely to gain wisdom by doing so.
That's a very wise comment. Yeah.
And so there are some good things in there if you're interested in it, but you have to be prepared that there's a lot of stuff that isn't as good in there, and it's not in the same category as Scripture.
I've also read through the Apocrypha many times, and I very much enjoy reading through it, but every time I go through it, my thought is that some of these narratives, some of these stories are really fascinating, and some of them, like Judith, are sort of that you think, wow, this could have been a modern feminist story. You know what, you got this lady who saves the Jews despite the cowardly guys behind the town walls and different things like that. But and I do like Judith. It's a great story. I just it's very entertaining. But as you think about most of these stories, they don't have the great doctrinal content and the great spirituality that the canonical books, or at least most of the canonical books, do. And so even though I like Maccabees and Baruch and some of the other things, I totally agree with you, John, not of the same caliber would be a great statement.
Well, I always like the humor of Tobit.
Another great book.
Here you have this guy, an angel comes down and tells him, so he's off to get his fortune, actually going to meet the woman he's going to marry. Eventually, I can't remember if he knows this or not. But an angel comes down when he's fishing at the streams, tells him to catch the fish and to take it out and save the fish guts. And it's another month before he arrives at his destination. And so he's got this bag of fish guts. And he's going to drive and he ends up driving the demon away by burning them. And I'm not even sure you'd need to burn them to scare just about anything away. You got these month-old fish guts.
That's about right.
When you don't have refrigeration.
Well, I've always remembered how to pronounce it by saying Tobit does not rhyme with Hobbit. So there you go. So, Kevin, anything else you want to add here about the Apocrypha or any of our other verses here?
Well, just several years ago, the Religious Studies at BYU put together a book called Apocryphal Writings and the Latter-day Saints that I've got, and I think it's really good, especially Richard L. Anderson's article on comparing through Nephi to some of the other modern stories about Jesus. I think it's really insightful. And there are several other essays in there by some top LDS scholars. I mean, it still provides good perspectives on just the whole issue, and also of how and when to use, the statements in D&C in this section of the Doctrine and Covenants as a guide.
Yeah, that is a great book. I haven't checked a lot of the more recent Religious Studies Center books. This is long out of print, but a lot of the recent ones are on their website in a digital form.
Yeah,
I'm not. I haven't checked this particular one, so that would be at least one place to look for it for listeners who are interested in reading some material on this. There's also, if you're interested in it, Jared Ludlow, about a year or two ago, came out with a book on an introduction to the Apocrypha for Latter-day Saint audience. And that one is probably still available. So for those who are interested in it, there are lots of good places. You can pick up a Catholic Bible if you want to read the translation of them. There are other translations of the Apocrypha. A lot of this material has been translated, so for those who want to get into the material, follow the Spirit and keep your eyes open for the good and the bad.
For the good and the bad. Well said. A little bit more of the backdrop of the Apocrypha. Joseph Smith gets this inspiration that he is to make an inspired, what we now call translation, but we might say expansion coupled with narrative or something of the Bible. And one of the fascinating things to me about the Joseph Smith translation, or the inspired version as we now call it, is that unlike the Book of Mormon, where he could not read the ancient language and therefore did not use the writing on the plates to read and then somehow pull out a dictionary and a concordance and somehow change it to English, it was purely by inspiration. The Bible that Joseph Smith used, at least initially in the inspired version, was something that Oliver Cowdery got from E.B. Grandin, and he got the Apocrypha, and it was in the Bible, and that was the King James Version with Apocrypha that Joseph Smith was going through. And so he started with the King James Version, and he added things, and he fixed things that he thought were inconsistent. And then you have these marvelous expansions, which are the part that I really like, that frankly doesn't have much to do with the Apocrypha, but I just love talking about it, which is, you know, the visions of Moses and...
And one of the things I'd like to add on the Joseph Smith translations, I guess because I'm in a position to do so, is that it's popular among Latter-day Saint scholars to say, well, this isn't really a translation. But in many cases it is, as that these are legitimate alternate translations of ancient texts that we still have. Some of it is inspired things that you can't necessarily find in an ancient manuscript, but that doesn't mean that all of that is. That's worth noting. And two other things about it. One of them is that Oliver got this from E.B. Grandin when the Book of Mormon was being printed. And as far as we know, this is the first Bible that Joseph Smith owned. So when he was translating the Book of Mormon, in one place they said they had to stop the translation and get a Bible, because they didn't have one, in to see if he wasn't being deceived. And so he didn't own a Bible before this, and this may have, when he was translating, it may have been the first time he'd read it.
Wow, that's a great point. Any parting comments, Kevin? We're just about out of time here.
Well, I just enjoyed the discussion and look forward to next month.
Sweet and to the point. Kevin, it's always a delight. I enjoy your thoughtful insights and comments, and likewise with you, John. Thank you so
much.
Thank
you, Martin, for stepping in and hosting. Terry Hutchinson should be back next month.
All right. Join us again next week right here on KTalk Media for Interpreter Radio from 7 to 9 p.m.